describe your pants and your shoes from France. But tell me what can be said about that bang on your head. It sure is big. I dig your wig.
Welcome back to Nocturnal General on 720 WGN. Ben Vaughn's I Dig Your Wig. Ben, are you there?
I am here.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Thanks for playing that song.
It's been a long time since I've seen you, at least. I want to say back to the Lounge Jacks days. You know, we've kind of kept in touch, but you're out in L.A.?
I am. I'm in Santa Monica right now.
Okay. So I wanted to start with I Dig Your Wig, because that's kind of was the window into me getting to know you a little bit. Tell us about that song and how it came to our to Lou Ritney and our friends the Morels.
Oh, boy. That's an interesting story.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The Morels, they were called the Skeletons before they were called the Morels, and then they went back to being called the Skeletons. And a friend of mine started a label called Ambition Records in 1980, and I was working as a paste-up artist at the time. I didn't have a music career at all. I was writing songs, and I wasn't playing them for anybody because I didn't know anybody outside of my small group of friends in New Jersey. And I did a 45 sleeve for the original Symptoms. The Morels went by three different names, one of which was the Symptoms, and they put a 45.
That was one of their problems. They didn't stay in one place too long.
You know? Yeah, I know. That might have something to do with why we're still educating people on their genius, because, I mean, the Morels, I mean, wow. They're the Morels, the Skeletons, the Symptoms, whatever you want to call them, are the people who are influenced by them and have heard them are rabid fans, but it's a very, very secretive society almost, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And so I did this 45 sleeve as a favor to a friend, and the Symptoms came to New York City, and Lou Whitney loved the 45 sleeve I did because it was a picture of the sax player from the Viscounts, but he had a Subaru transmission in his mouth instead of a saxophone. And Lou recognized that it was a Subaru transmission.
Yeah, Lou was a car guy. Yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't even a cool car. A Subaru? Yeah. No. It wasn't like a Chevy or a Ford or, you know, or a Cadillac or anything. It was a Subaru transmission, and he thought that was the greatest thing he'd ever seen, and he insisted that I come up to their show in New York and introduce myself because he wanted to meet me. And when I saw them play, I could not believe what I was watching, because this was 1981, maybe, or 1980. They were opening for a new wave band in New York, whose name I can't remember, at the Peppermint Lounge, and it was definitely new wave season. You know, I mean, the club was just completely filled with hipsters. And the Morels came out, and they looked like they had just finished working on their cars.
Right.
You know? Like Donnie was wearing a flannel shirt, which back then no one did, you know.
Yeah.
And they came out and they played this amazing set. So after the set, I introduced myself to Lou, and I started naming all the great song. You know, I just started, you know, describing how great I thought their show was and gave him details. And he looked at me and said, "Are you a musician?" And I said, "Well, I'm a songwriter." And he goes, "Well, we don't write songs much, so if you got some, send them." And I did, and they just started playing. I think they probably did maybe 10 of my songs by, you know, last count that I had.
It's a great marriage. I mean, I don't have them all in front of me, but 7 Days Without Love makes 1 week. Yeah, that was, they covered that. That's yours. They did I Dig Your Wig that you played, right?
Yeah.
Man Who Has Everything. That was great live.
Yeah, Looking for 7-Eleven, Lover's Leap. I mean, it goes, the list goes on. And they also did a song written by a friend of mine, also an unknown guy in my neighborhood, called Growing a Beard, which a lot of people think I wrote, but I didn't. I took what my friend thought was a folk song, and I turned it into a kind of a Carl Perkins thing, and I sent a tape of it to Lou, and he went berserk over that one, and they put that on the Shake and Push album.
You know, I could come in here every Saturday night and talk about Lou and the Morels and the Skeletons. I mean, it's just I'm with you, man. They were such a great band. You did a Facebook post when Lou passed away about Lou Whitney changed my life. So you were saying, I mean, you were doing this artwork and stuff, and how did he change your life? Were things stagnant for you? What turns did you make after you met him?
Well, I mean, he heard my songs and said, you know, you should not be working a day job. I don't know if you know, he said, I don't know if you know how great you are, but you're great. And I was like, really? And he's like, he was just stunned that I wasn't aware that I had something going on that was, could go nationwide, you know. I was living in an environment where no one made it. You know, I didn't know anyone who even, you know, got a record deal or anything, you know, in New Jersey. So I had never been on a guest list before Lou put me on one. that was why I went. I was telling my friends I'm on a guest list at New York City. You know, and I drove up. I remember it was January and it was really cold. And I drove my '65 Rambler up there that had no heat. And I was wearing a down parka in my car just so I wouldn't die. And got up there and. He just really encouraged me, and he just started telling everybody about me, which led to me. He told Ira Kaplan, who at the time was writing for the Village Voice. He's the guy in Yola Tango.
Yeah,
at the time he wasn't a musician or performing musician anyway, and he was writing for the Village Voice, and Ira was a big fan of the Morels. So Lou said, "Well, you got to get into this guy here because this guy is the songwriter, you know." And he really pushed me hard on a lot of people, and I became kind of legitimate overnight because of Lou. Because people really, you know, Lou had something going on, a real commanding personality, but also an intelligence and an appreciation of music that when you were around him, you just let him talk and you listened because you knew you were going to learn something, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody felt that way about Lou. So here he is telling everybody about me. You know, the message was spread pretty fast, and I went really, things moved real fast for me. I mean, Marshall Crenshaw picked up one of my songs not that long after, and things just started moving really fast.
He got I'm Sorry, But So Is Brenda Lee. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, for Marshall. Yeah. You know, I've interviewed you a few times, but I never asked you about, I don't know if I'm making a stretch here, but your career as a paste-up artist, is that a metaphor for some of the music you did later on? I mean, the cut-and-paste type stuff, different styles and things like that? Or is that just too out there, a question?
Well, I mean, the fact that paste-up artist is now a job that doesn't exist, I don't think we... I'm not sure if I want to be... if I want to be my music compared to that... Yeah. No, with me, music is, wow. I mean, it's ever since I was a kid, I never really cared about whether I was listening to Hello Dolly by Louis Armstrong or a Stones record or a Wilson Pickett record. You know, it came flying. I was, you know, I'm lucky to be old enough to remember AM radio when it was, everything was considered pop music, you know, whether it was Dean Martin or the Beatles or Bob Dylan or even Bobby Goldsboro, or it was all coming out of the radio. Within an hour, you heard Roger Miller even, you know.
Yeah, right.
All this stuff came flying out. So I was too young to know that they were different genres. It all was the same to me. And it's kind of how I approach songwriting and performing and record making.
Yeah, you told me once. I mean, that's why I wanted to have you on the show. There was a real magic to you. Grew up on Philadelphia radio, the '60s, the Geeter, and you would listen to stuff like the Apology Line. And you said it was like there was a magic radio for you, where there was like a real thing going on. It was really honest, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I also, my dad was a TV repairman, and so we had a shortwave radio in the house that I moved up to my bedroom, and I listened to the BBC and Radio Luxembourg too when I was like 10 years old. I was kind of a fanatic, you know. The cold winter nights in New Jersey, picking up, you know, I would listen to the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah.
And I would listen to WLS in Chicago, not to mention a competitor.
Yeah.
But on Sunday nights, they had a British countdown.
Did they?
Where a guy pretended to be British. He was actually a local Chicago guy, and he would pretend, he called himself Lord something, I think, you know, or, you know, Sir Lord something or other. And I would listen to that every Sunday night, and I would listen to WLS, and I would listen, you know, Buckingham's Crying Shames, all that stuff. You know, you had a lot of great local records in Chicago that never got played in Philadelphia, but I listened to them at night, just moving around a dial. So I kind of knew early on, probably like you and a lot of your listeners, that when you get the bug like that, there's nothing is going to stop you from getting the information. You know, you're really open to it and available to it. You're like a magnet. It comes toward you, you know, and you seek it out, but it's also trying to find you at the same time. So it's always been just like a natural flow of information that I really feel lucky that I got bit by the bug, because, you know, music, wow.
Yeah.
Nothing better.
You do your own radio show, weekly radio show, The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn?
I do. It's on in 8 markets now. It started in Memphis. They asked me to record a weekly show and send it to them, and I called it The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn, and it caught on down there, and then I have 7 other stations where it's going, and we're picking up stations as we go. There's a good audience starting to build for it.
And what do you do on there? Do you play music? Do you do interviews?
No interviews, really. I've done a few, but mainly it's freeform radio, kind of like what you would hear in 1971 on FM, but a little less hip. Yeah. You know, like, you know, I will play Rob McEwen, you know,
uh-huh.
But you know, jazz, bluegrass, folk, rock and roll, punk, reggae, you know, but the songs, the way I blend them into each other is more musical. I don't really try to do anything in theory in my head. Like, wouldn't it be really daring to play the Sex Pistols right after Dolly Parton, you know, or anything like that? It's less conscious. I'm listening to the music as I audition stuff and just kind of go with key changes and production sound. You know, I'm a record producer, so I'm kind of I listen to music in detail when I hear it. The separation of instruments and the stereo imaging and reverbs and all that stuff are kind of what I'm listening to. So when I'm putting a show together, I mix it almost sort of like mosaic, I guess, of music that blends together, whether it's country or rock or whatever. That the genres don't matter as much as whether the music flows well.
When was the last time you were in Chicago playing music?
Boy, the last time I think I played that, I'm pretty sure it was 1994.
It's been that long. Wow.
Yeah, and I played with Alex Chilton. We toured together a whole lot. And you interviewed the two of us.
Yeah, right. Remember that? Yeah. That went well.
Yeah, for that show.
Yeah, right.
That's right. We were writing songs. We were trying to write songs together. And nothing ever really got finished. We were keeping different hours. By the time I was ready by the time he was ready to write, I was ready to go to bed. So, you know, he wanted to write after, you know, we were on tour. And so he said, you know, after we play the gig, we'll go back to the hotel, you know, and we'll start writing. So, which means like 2:30 or 3 in the morning, you know. And I wasn't at my sharpest. But I'm trying to remember the Metro. Yeah, Club Metro. Is that what it's
yeah,
called?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I played Lounge Axe a bunch of times.
I saw you at Lounge Axe, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and also the Cubby Bear and that place, I think it's called Park West. I think
yeah,
I played
it's
there.
Still here. That's still here. Okay, we got to take a break, and then I want to come back and talk about Arthur Alexander. Is that okay with you?
Oh, I would love to.
Okay. All right, don't go away. We're going to be back with more Ben Vaughn on WGN.
I believe
Wow. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal with our special guest, Ben Vaughn. And, man, I get goosebumps still listening to Arthur Alexander. It's from the album Lonely Just Like Me, produced by Ben Vaughn in 1993. I mean, take away the story, Ben. I mean, you had to track him down. It was part of the American Explorer series for Elektra. But how'd you find out Arthur, and what was it like to work with him?
Well, first of all, what a voice, huh?
Yeah, I know. It's got that, yeah. It's
just hearing that just now, I'm feeling the same way you are. It's just, I miss the guy, you know? I really miss the guy.
It gave me goosebumps.
Oh, yeah. And that's he was the gentle giant, you know? He was a very large guy, but he had that voice. Was just, there was so much emotion and pain in there. You really wanted him to come out of it okay. And every song, pretty much, you know, just rooting for the guy. What happened is Elektra Records, for a while there, had a series called the American Explorer series. And they hired me to produce Charlie Feathers in the first batch. Actually, I told them, I actually insisted they do Charlie Feathers or their series was not legitimate. That's how that happened. I insulted the guy, and he said, if you can get Charlie in the studio, you got a deal. And then I realized that was really not easy. Charlie was the most cantankerous person I've ever met in my life and liked to fight. But we did a Charlie Feathers record, and it was received really well, so they... they kept the series going, and one of the artists they were interested in bringing back was Arthur Alexander. And
who we should say, I mean, I always assume we've got to sometimes educate some listeners. I mean, big influence on the Beatles and the Stones, Arthur Alexander.
Oh, yeah.
Anna.
Yeah, the Beatles did Anna, and the Rolling Stones did You Better Move On. Right. And Muscle Shoals, the first artist to really come out of Muscle Shoals that anyone heard of. And but he disappeared pretty quickly. He had a couple R&B hits, was pretty popular in England, and then just fell off the radar for 30 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many years. And he was working at a social center in Cleveland and was driving a bus for these disadvantaged kids that were being rehabilitated and helped out, kind of like a social program. And that's what he was doing, and he was off drugs and alcohol and everything. He was leading this really quiet life, and Danny Kahn, who was the executive producer of that series, he called me up and said, hey, Arthur Alexander, what do you think? And I said, boy, you know, if you can get Arthur Alexander back in the studio, you're a genius. He said, well, we're going to fly you to Cleveland and you're going to convince him. And I said, all right, I'm game, you know. And I flew up to Cleveland, and I met with Arthur, and we played. I brought a guitar with me, and we played, and he sang, and it was amazing. I'm in a hotel room with Arthur Alexander, you know, a guy no one has heard of in years, and his voice sounded great. And we talked about his life and everything, and he said that he was very happy living the life he was living and very happy to be away from showbiz. And he kind of convinced me, you know. And I said, well, you know, if we make a record, it could change your life, because people are going to like it a lot, and then they're going to want to see you on stage, and there's going to be some professional activity. Your life, you know, could change. So maybe you shouldn't do this. And then he convinced me. I tried to talk him out of it. He talked me right back into it. So we became good friends, and we recorded the record in Nashville with his old buddies, Donnie Fritz and Dan Penn.
Dan Penn's been on the show. Yeah, right.
Oh, Dan's great.
Yeah, right.
Dan is a great guy. He's one of the most authentic human beings I've ever met.
Yeah.
We recorded in Nashville. And we had the American Studios band, Reggie Young, Gene Chrisman, and Mike Leach, augmented with Dan and Spooner. And we cut the whole thing, I think, in 3 days, I think. And Arthur was a little nervous about getting in front of the microphone. But as soon as, you know, we hit record, it was the musicians were so supportive because they were so happy that Arthur was back, because they were huge fans and they wondered what happened to him, and they were worried, you know, that something, you know, that Arthur went down the wrong road and never made it back. So they were thrilled that he was in the studio and in good health, or what we thought was good health. Unfortunately, we finished the record. It came out. A lot of accolades happened. Arthur performed at South by Southwest, and we were rehearsing for a tour. And we had a lot of big things lined up. And I was going to be the band leader. And Arthur took ill in Nashville. We went to Nashville to play an outdoor show at a festival. And after the show, Arthur didn't feel well. And the next day, he was taken to the hospital, and he died 3 days later of a kidney failure.
53 years old?
53, I know. It was that was hard for us, because we had, a few of us, you know, had just become new friends with Arthur, and he was such an endearing guy, and he was such a guy who really deserved that second break musically. Luckily, what happened, though, is he got a chance to see what his music meant to people in the end, because he was being interviewed by everybody and signing records everywhere he went. People were showing up out of the woodwork and were just, he was really surprised. He was really, really surprised.
I want to say there was a reissue of this, Lonely Just Like Me, with some great inserts. And Ben, you wrote a thing called The Final Chapter. Was it true that he was in Nashville right before he passed? He was negotiating to get his publishing rights back right at the end there?
Yeah, he signed, actually, and then collapsed at the publisher's office. You could not make a better movie. If you took that story to a Hollywood studio, they would say, go back and rewrite it, because that stuff never really happens. That's really true. It's really true. I helped a little bit, but it was Bug Publishing, who they're kind of known for recapturing.
Yeah, I know those guys.
Arthur signed up with Bug, and we were in the process of getting his publishing back. And he sat down for that meeting and signed whatever piece of paper it was to really give them the right to go get this stuff back for his family, for him and his family. And then he collapsed and was taken to the hospital.
We're going to break for the news. Can you hang on a little bit longer? Because I want to talk about some of your current stuff that you've been doing, and then we'll let you go. Thanks for coming in live on a Saturday night. I really appreciate that, making yourself available, Ben. Can you hang on a little bit longer?
I sure can.
Okay. So don't go away after the news. We'll be back a little bit more. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN in Chicago. That's a snippet of Fat City from Cubist Blues with Alan Vega, Alex Chilton, and Ben Vaughn. Ben, I want to keep you a little bit in the time you have left. I was in a record store in Memphis. I picked this up recently, reissued by Light in the Attic Records. It's a show you guys did in New York in 1994.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And again, I mean, we've talked about Alex, but Alex Chilton, tell us about Alan. I know we just lost him, but from suicide.
Alan Vega, you know, if your listeners are familiar with Suicide, they were an electronic duo that came out in, you know, the mid-70s, in the middle of the punk scene. They were actually together longer than that, but they didn't make a record until 77, and they were drum machine and keyboards and vocal, and that was it. But it didn't sound German, like Kraftwerk or anything. It was American rock and roll, almost like Gene Vincent or something.
with an electronic beat and a very really, really spirited vocalist in Alan Vega, kind of like a beat poet, singing like Elvis. He made some rockabilly records, in particular a song called Jukebox Babe, which was a revelation to me when I heard it. It's one of those records that I heard and I said, oh, wow, you can really make modern rockabilly. You know, instead of being retro, it was modern rockabilly. And big inspiration to me. And when I finally met him, we became friends right away. We really clicked. And we had talked for a long time about doing a late night blues record, like a midnight blues record together, because I always thought he was sort of a blues singer. And he agreed with me on that. And we finally got it together in 1994, I think it was. I booked time. I said, okay, we're going to do it. And he said, look, I don't want to know what musicians you're bringing, and I don't want to write any songs, and I don't want to even talk about it. I want zero expectations. It's the only way I think this can work is if we just turn the lights down and we begin and we have no expectations about what it is it's going to sound like or anything.
Like this radio show, right?
Yeah. Like your career.
Yeah, right.
and mine. I had never worked like that before, you know, and I always took studio time as a serious thing. Like, you know, we're paying for time. We should know what we're doing. And he was refusing to give me that luxury, that comfort zone. It was a real challenge to me. And I was talking to Alex Chilton on the phone about it. And I told him, I said, you know, I'm producing Alan Vega, and I'm taking him into the studio, but he won't let me have any comfortable feelings about it. He wants it to be completely off the cuff. Even if it fails, he wants to take that risk. And Alex said, that sounds perfect. Can I play on it? I would love to be part of a project like that. I love Alan Vega, and that approach really sounds cool to me. And I said, sure. I said, there's no money to pay you to fly you up to New York. And he said, I'll do it for free. I'll pay my own way. And he did. And we got together for two nights in the studio and completely improvised that album. And it's, and then we did two shows to promote it. 2 years later, we got back together and played one show in New York and one show at a festival in France. And I'm not even sure what type of music you call what we were playing. We never got together again and did it after that show in 96, I think it was. We played in France. We went our separate ways, and we were all very busy with other things. Never got together and played again. So we only really did it maybe four nights total. We were a band for four nights, two in the studio, two on stage.
Fans will know Springsteen did what? Dream Baby Dream, Dream 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 Dream.
Bruce Springsteen is a huge Suicide
fan.
Suicide
fan, right.
Because the Suicide album was recorded at the same studio Springsteen did Born to Run. Up in New York, in Blau Belt, New York, I think it was, is the name of the town. And so Springsteen has always been an Alan Vega fan, and actually has been opening shows. Alan died, Bruce was opening his shows with Dream Baby Dream as a tribute. So a big influence on him. Alan Vega was a real artist, a true artist, probably the most pure artist I've ever worked with. He really did not consider himself a musician or a singer or a songwriter or even a performer. He was, he had the most fiercely artistic way about him. It was all about immediacy. It was really inspiring and a real education for me.
You produced, in the time we have left, you produced a new record with him, you said, soon to be released?
Yeah. About a year and a half ago at this point, we went into the studio. Alan has suffered a stroke, and he was recovering, and we decided to play music together just to see how he felt, you know, and we went in to the studio and we recorded, and he came up with some amazing stuff. It was really, really frightening how powerful he was. So, yeah, I'm not sure who's putting it out yet. There's several labels were in discussions. You know, Alan passed away, I guess it was about 2 months ago, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're moving a little slow because we all got hit hard by that news.
You wrote a really nice eulogy to him on the Daily Beast.
Yeah, I was happy to spread the word. The Daily Beast called me up and said, the guy who is the editor of the opinion page said, "Look, I'm a huge Alan Vega fan, and nobody here at the Daily Beast knows who he is. You have to help me fix this. Please write something." And I was pretty upset, you know, because I just learned that Alan died, and wasn't sure if I could come up with something. But when I thought about the idea that more people needed to know Alan's music, it was pretty easy to figure out what to write. It was just an amazing guy. Just an amazing guy.
Well, thank you. Man, you got to come back before the year is out, because I want to talk about your stuff. I want to talk about Texas Road Trip. We got to talk about that on Many Moods Records, right?
People can find out about you
at benvaughn.com, right?
Yep, that's the best place to go.
Am I missing anything else? I want to tell our next guest, the Bedbugs. They should be covering some Ben Vaughn. I'm gonna hook you guys up with them. Okay, the Bedbugs.
The Bedbugs. Yeah, I love that name.
Yeah, they're.
How come no one's used that before, these guys?
I don't know. They've been around. We're going to get to that. 85, you guys have been around? They're from South Chicago, the steel mill section of Chicago. I love these guys. And, Ben, I'm excited. Tonight's going to be the first time I've seen them sober.
Oh, boy. I just lost interest.
But thank you so much, Ben. You're the best. Will you come back?
I will definitely come back, and I will also come back to your town physically.
Yeah, I'd love to. You got to come back here. God, I can't believe it's been that long. So, yeah.
It's been a real long time, yeah.
Okay. All right, my friend, let's stay in touch, and thank you for being so generous with your time on a Saturday night.
Sure, and give my regards to the Bedbugs.
Oh, okay, I will.